Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday morning. It's June 17th. I will make a quick announcement that it's my wife's birthday, so I want to wish Kelly a very, very happy birthday. She may actually be listening. So, happy birthday, Kelly. I want to thank everybody for joining in and for being with us this morning. It is lovely to have you all here. Let me bring in the group, and we'll start talking about what's going on in the world. A reminder, you are always invited to join in and to share your thoughts. All you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org. Keep your letters short and to the point. Don't include links or attachments, and please proofread so we know exactly what you want to say, because otherwise it can occasionally be embarrassing for us and for you.
And how about one to a customer?
One to a customer is another great rule. Also, just so people know, some people think they'll get the upper hand and they'll send in letters at like 4 a.m. Well, if we don't get it during the show, we don't read it, because we want it to be reactive to what we're talking about. So just keep that in mind as well. All right. With all of that said, let me introduce the group. You've just heard the main voice here, WAMC's Alan Chartok. Good morning, sir. How are you?
You, sir, are the main voice.
Oh,
and I want to join in on your congratulations to your wonderful wife, who I adore. I really think she's the best thing going in since bread. She's terrific.
Well, I don't disagree with you, and I thank you. And
she is really wonderful. And I just want to say zippity doo dah, zippity a, my oh my, what a wonderful day! It's a beautiful day out there,
it
right?
It is a beautiful day, and it is just a perfect summer day, and a good day to be sitting around the radio and bitching about things going on in the news. So here we go. Let's go to our good friend Rosemary Armeo. She is an investigative journalist. She is a UAlbany adjunct professor and our good friend. Good morning, Rosemary. How are you?
Good morning. Very well. Happy birthday, Kelly.
Thank you for that. By the way, I just will say that she hates this, but okay.
I'm sorry, Kelly.
No, I learned early in our marriage. Times Union columnist Chris Churchill is here. Good morning, Chris. How are you?
Good morning, Joe, and happy birthday, Kelly.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris. And the dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Cybersecurity at the University of Albany, Bob Griffin. Bob, I got to tell you, we got more than a few letters last week. You had to leave early, and Chris mentioned it on the air, and then a lot of people said this. It's a little concerning when you have an emergency preparedness Homeland Cybersecurity guy who has to leave quickly.
That's funny.
Yeah, Joe, and I won't wish Kelly a happy birthday, even though I feel it in my heart. I want all of the listeners to know that actually Alan and Joe ordered this weather after the amazing fun drive. So next time you have a fun drive, when you give, they will order more of this weather. So,
yeah, you bet.
Just wanted to give props to that.
Yeah, clouds have cleared.
At some point in time, I'll tell you the story. I was subject of a really sophisticated spear phishing and cyber attack at the same time of last week's show. So it's
wow.
At some point in time, I'll tell you the story.
Okay. Well, you've set it up beautifully. All right. Let's go again. A reminder, you can join in on the conversation, panel@wamc.org. Now that our group has been identified, let's get to the work at hand. So what we know is that a lot on the corona front, Florida, Texas, Arizona, all setting record for the most cases they have reported in a single day. This is far from over, friends, and many of us know that. Some perhaps do not. However, these are sobering numbers. We have seen this, obviously, and have gone through much of this in the Northeast, in New York, of course, Massachusetts, Connecticut, New Jersey, Pennsylvania. But Florida reported 2,783 new cases just yesterday. Texas reported 2,622, and Arizona reported 2,392. All three states have increased testing and moved swiftly to ease social distancing restrictions and allow more businesses to reopen. They were among 20 states that have seen the number of newly reported cases grow over the last 2 weeks. Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida attributed the uptick to more widespread testing, noting in a news conference Tuesday that the state was not only testing far more people than it did earlier in the spring, but was also going into high-risk environments, testing farm workers and migrant workers, and finding new cases. But I will ask, I'll go to Bob first, but Bob, they still have the cases, right? I mean, this idea of the more you test, I mean, the president has even posited over the last few days the opposite, that the way to take care of this is stop testing.
Yeah, it's an interesting policy position. I call it the ostrich. It's when you stick your head in the sand and your keister in the air. I would say that I think that we have increasing numbers in a lot of other states that are undercounting. And I would point to places like Missouri and Georgia as areas of concern. Fauci was right. CDC, when they actually could give fair and unbiased professional opinion, were right about the spread. And what should be disconcerting to folks is that this is a continuation of the first wave. This isn't the second wave. So I think that we have a lot more pain in front of us. And I personally hold the governors responsible for pushing to reopen too quickly and undoing all of the good work that was done and the sacrifices that were made.
The other two stories, main stories when it comes to coronavirus, the president of Honduras has tested positive for coronavirus. Also, we mentioned what's going on in this country. To Bob's point, of the three states I mentioned and other states that are seeing upticks, or we assume that's a lot of it anecdotal because the numbers are not being fully reported. But an outbreak in Beijing also bringing a new round of restrictions, and that's concerning too, isn't it, Bob? This is where this all started.
Yeah, it's very concerning. For a while there, China was trumpeting the fact that they had no new coronaviruses, and then all of a sudden we see Beijing, their major city, going into a pretty significant lockdown. And if I could sort of spread the wealth of pessimism on a beautiful day, you know, you start to look at the news out of China, you start to think about also, you start to see the Chinese-Indian aggression on the border.
Right.
You see China pushing on Taiwan. You see China pushing on Hong Kong. They are doing everything in their power to sort of take away from the main story. I'll also note, for those that may not have seen this, is that China is trying to put the blame on the new corona cases from European exports. So I think there's an awful lot of pain going on. I'll also note, and maybe it's a comment from some of the other panelists, is the last time I saw Dr. Fauci was on a milk carton. He's absolutely been missing in action, which is so unfortunate, because he was a voice of reason and I think was really good for not only the public policymakers, but for the economy as well, because you get a sense that he knew what the hell he was talking about.
He told Newsweek that he has not talked to the president in weeks, for whatever it's worth.
Yeah.
Don't listen to anybody who's going to contradict you. That's for sure. Bob, you have done the thing of the morning. As far as I'm concerned, you know, your image of the president with his keister up in the air is something that I won't forget soon.
As much as we want to, by the way.
And by the way, I do think the guy is complicit in, I hate to say it because I'll get criticized for it, but I think he's complicit in murder. And here's why. I honestly think that when you invite tens of thousands of people into an auditorium, right, and you make them sign saying they're coming even though they know they're in danger, and you know there's going to be a fallout from this, you're involving yourself in what has to be seen as a death notice.
Quick clarification that Dr. Fauci actually told that to NPR. They released it yesterday, so I labeled it as Newsweek, but it was NPR where the interview was held. Chris Churchill.
Well, obviously the rising number of cases, it's not good news. If you're looking for a bright spot, it's that the numbers are still relatively low, right? I mean, Florida and Texas aren't experiencing anything close to what, you know, the northeastern states experienced. And, you know, but the problem is if you go up by 5% every day and that compounds, you can get to pretty high numbers pretty quickly.
Well, especially if you're not practicing the social distancing. And, I mean, you think of all the things that we did in New York to flatten the curve, so to speak, and also to – but we're doing the opposite. We're ramping up.
Yeah, in some parts of – well, I mean, like in Texas, for example, some parts of the state are ramping up. But then some areas where the virus has a harder hold, like Houston, you know, there are local – governments that are doing things. You know, Texas is an awfully big state. It's kind of like you can have different conditions in different parts of the state. So I can understand in ways why they want to do it on more of a local level. That makes some sense to me. You know, West Texas is not the same as Houston by a long shot.
Rosemary.
Well, I mean, we know by now very well that the federal government is not going to take the lead in getting us out of this jungle of disease. And so if you're signing away your right to health and saying, okay, if I get COVID, that's on me. If you're going to beaches not wearing a mask, if you're going to restaurants that are now opening and getting too close to other people, and I went, that is on you. It is not on Fauci. It's not even on Trump. He's done a terrible job, no question about it, but I have to hit the drumbeat for personal responsibility again.
Well, you're right, but my problem with it is that Trump is encouraging people to be in a space where he knows they're going to get the disease because he has basically said, sign this paper that says you don't hold me responsible. Incredible.
Sure. I mean, I don't applaud him. I think what he's doing is deplorable. But if you're so stupid, if you cannot avail yourself of the ample information of the spread and the severity of this disease, and you sign up for that rally, that's on you.
Yeah, I understand your point. Okay, Bob, I think, were you going to speak?
Yeah, Joe, if I
go
can
ahead.
Jump in,
yeah.
You know, in my head, though, there's a big difference. You know, for someone who is forced to have to go back to work in order to keep a roof over their heads or their family fed, that's to me, that may be an acceptable risk, although I think we need to do everything possible to try to keep them safe, including, you said, personal responsibility, including the visitors, guests, patrons wearing protective gear, including masks. Where I think Alan is correct, though, is that there are other ways that Trump could have a rally. You don't have to have it face to face. And you know, he's purposely bringing people together. And on one hand, he's telling everybody that this is a big hoax and it's going away or it's going away. And on the other hand, they're signing a waiver saying, oh, by the way, if you get sick, we're not going to be responsible. I mean, to me, it is incredibly irresponsible. And what scares me, though, is for those people that may get sick from that rally, they're going to be taking hospital space. They're going to be taking medical care away from the other members of the population.
It seems, though, that we're conflating two things. One is the rally taking place on Saturday in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And the other is the rising numbers in these states where, yes, even if you are – but if you are somebody who is wearing a mask, you are still being – very much threatened by all of those who aren't, and the cheerleading of this administration, including going to what the vice president said yesterday, that you don't have to wear a mask, things are better, it's all going to blow over, when the evidence is the opposite.
Joe, a couple of things. One of them is that in Oklahoma, the numbers are going up right now, where he's going to have the rally.
Correct.
That's number one. That's interesting. And number two, when you wear a mask, you know, they've assigned percentages to some of these masks. One mask is a 90%. The other mask is a 60%. That means 40% chance you're wearing the mask and you can get the disease. That's something we shouldn't forget.
And it's still, yeah, but I'll still take 60 over not wearing a mask at all of having somebody walk next to me, right? I mean, Bob,
I take 60, but I wouldn't subscribe to the idea that the president of the United States is correct when he says wear a mask or anybody else says wear a mask because it doesn't always work. That's the point.
Bob?
I actually think Chris was trying to get in.
Oh, Chris, I'm sorry.
I have a thought after Chris.
Chris, oh, I just sort of...
Yeah, I was just going to say that I don't understand people who both want to reopen the economy and suggest don't wear masks, because to me they go hand in hand. The only way you can even really remotely... If you want to get the economy going again, then you pretty much have to accept that widespread mask wearing is going to be the kind of the best protection we have. And I take Alan's point about it's not perfect. Nothing ever really is. But, you know, it's the best that we have, and you can't have both. You can't say go out and then don't wear your mask, because then you're risking a kind of return to what we just experienced a few months ago. That seems reckless to me.
And they're opening up all the restaurants in Great Barrington, or many of the restaurants in Great Barrington, as you wear your mask. Have they figured out how to get
the
food
in
your...
kind of hard to eat while wearing a mask.
Have they figured that out yet?
Yeah. No, it's very awkward.
I keep staining my mask with coffee.
And I don't know if any of you have done it, but you forget, and then all of a sudden, a fork goes under the mask. We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Rosemary Armeo, Bob Griffin, we welcome your letters. panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Again, we'll continue our conversation with a very good group this morning, and we'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. 34 minutes past 9 o'clock. Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Rosemary Armeo, and Bob Griffin, and we welcome your letters panel@wamc.org. I want to get to the letters in just a second. Another aspect of this story, there's a article in the Washington Post this morning that says to prepare for the next pandemic, the U.S. needs to change its national security priorities, according to experts. 3 months after President Trump declared a national emergency because of the coronavirus, officials and analysts are again asking whether national security should be drastically recalibrated this time around the threat of pandemic. According to a former senior official at the U.S. Agency for International Development, quote, we need to treat this moment like we treated 9/11, recognizing that we have a massive vulnerability in which we have chronically underinvested. The Washington Post spoke to 29 current and former officials, lawmakers, and experts to ask how the coronavirus pandemic would change U.S. national security. The officials served in Republican and Democratic administrations in the White House, the military, the intelligence community, and the State Department. Many of them claim no party affiliation. The responses showed areas of broad consensus. Nearly to a person, they said the government should not create another big bureaucracy. It took years to fully organize DHS, a department which has since narrowed its focus mainly to immigration and border control, not counterterrorism. Large structural organizations would absorb time better spent making existing systems work more efficiently, they say. The United States did create new programs after the 2001 9/11 attacks to defend the country from pandemics. Public health, security, and military officials have responded to less severe outbreaks over the years and simulated pandemics on the scale of the coronavirus. The intelligence community also has warned for years in classified and public reports that pandemic disease is at least as serious a security problem as terrorism, as well as cyber attacks and the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. None of it has seemed to make much difference. Bob, this is your field, so let us begin with you.
Yeah, Joe, thanks. And thanks, Mike Bowen, for that great music. So back to the question at hand. I agree with a lot of what was said in the article. I think it would be an enormous mistake to create a new organization. And frankly, I, having been in the bowels of DHS, I could tell you that it's still very much a work in progress. And frankly, even though it's structured around immigration at this moment, I think that's going to change depending upon what comes down as far as hurricanes or terrorist attacks. I think some of the things we can do are just put back in place links and coordination efforts that were existing prior to the Trump administration. And understand, this isn't just about the Obama administration. This goes back to Bush 2, Bush 1, Clinton. There needs to be better coordination at the national security level. There also needs to be an all-of-government approach. And this is where the federal government plays such an important role, Joe. You know, it's it's the stockpile. It's making sure that we're providing grants for equipment to hospitals in the medical community, not just the law enforcement community. It's making sure that Commerce and Treasury are working out plans that would help incentivize companies to actually produce pharmaceuticals and protective equipment here. But we absolutely, as a nation, need to take this head on as a warning shot, because as bad as COVID is, and I don't want to downplay the suffering and loss of 117,000 Americans, it could be worse. And we need to be prepared for that.
Rosemary?
Well, it seems that we keep playing this shell game. Like, it used to be that we paid attention to crime, international crime, and white-collar crime here in the country. And then we switched all the agencies, including the FBI, which is not in Homeland Security, but all the agencies then switched their attention to anti-terrorism. And now we want to switch to pandemic. The truth is that all of these are matters that a government should be concerned with. I'm not sure that we need new structures. Maybe we should fill up the ranks of the structures we already have, for example, the State Department, which might, for example, in this pandemic have worked better with China. Also, a change in the presidential office would make a big difference in how we used organizations that are giving us warning, that do have tools. The CDC was hobbled by Donald Trump. Creating a new agency for him to control and demand loyalty of won't fix that. So, again, I put the problem more on Trump than on the way government has worked in the past.
Alan?
Well, it's so clear to me that when you're dealing with priorities, you have to decide which ones are more important. Are we really more worried about international relations, the Russians, the Chinese, the whatever? Or are we worried about all those bodies that are piling up around here as a result of this intransigence on Trump's part as to whether or not he really, on some level, understands what he's doing here and doesn't care. So from where I'm sitting, this is a terrible situation, and it should be a number one priority. And it's that simple.
And Chris Churchill.
So from my point of view, the kind of the number one job of a president is to effectively manage the bureaucracy that they're in charge of. I mean, it's not a very glamorous role. It's not one that comes up very much during the campaigns. But it is kind of what they're there for. And the problem with Trump and his administration is that they've just never, I mean, they have a kind of open disdain for that bureaucracy, and they've never treated the expertise within it as very important. And they got away with it for a few years, I suppose. But when the pandemic hit, they got caught. You know, I mean, their lack of preparation and all the unfilled positions that we've talked about here over the years. I mean, it all came back to bite them. And you know, Bob can speak to this better than I can. But it just seems like they just did not know how to coordinate between the various branches the way they should have. They didn't listen to the people they should have been listening to. And the results were predictably bad.
Bob?
Yeah, if I could. I mean, several really good points. A lot of what happens in government and policy is and should be really boring. And in fact, if government is doing its job, you don't know it's there. It's when government isn't doing its job that you start to see it in press. I need to give some sympathy to the administration. For 30 years I've been looking at disasters and emergency preparedness, and the pandemic is by far the hardest scenario to deal with. If you think about a hurricane coming in, the hurricane is going to impact only portions of the nation, which would allow us to move resources from those other unaffected areas. So that idea of mutual support is sort of baked into everything that we do and we plan for. A pandemic, though, and this is the first time where all 50 states had concurrent declarations of disaster or emergency, which means that there is no mutual support. With that said, This is exactly what FEMA and CDC and Health and Human Services and DHS should have been working on. This is exactly why you have the National Security Council, because it is meant to coordinate all of those functions. I would also note that it also shows, I think, one of the glaring weaknesses in federal budgeting. It's not putting enough money back into local governments and states, particularly when you start to think about what that means for public health. It's putting more and more money only into the Department of Defense and the military, and it's showing. It's showing the funding that isn't going to National Institutes of Health, it isn't going into some of the more basic and even some of the applied research in this area, is showing. And so you're right when you say this has been an area of neglect. This administration played Russian roulette, and unfortunately the bullet was in the chamber this time. The other thing that I will note, we actually as a nation started to build up a really decent capacity after, if you think about after 9/11 and the anthrax attacks, there was a whole movement dealing with epidemiology and really starting to create a robust network. And that network really got taken apart, not even by this administration, really by the recession. And the numbers have never, ever come back. And that's something where we as a nation have got to have a much longer memory than we typically do.
Rosemary?
No, I don't think I have anything to add to that. That was a pretty good analysis.
Excellent. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters. We'll go to the letters when we return. We welcome them. Panel at WAMC.org. And we will go with our group here, of course, Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Rosemary Mayo, and Bob Griffin, right after this break. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We got a lot of letters, and we have quite a bit on the rally. So I'll go with a couple of those. This from Mark, who says, do not fail to mention that the essential reason for the upcoming political rally in Tulsa is not the usual motivation to convince undecided or unmotivated voters to support the president's reelection, but rather because the president enjoys and misses large cheering crowds. People are knowingly or unknowingly risking their health in order to feed the president's narcissism. That is at the core. It is immoral. Also,
Joe, I'd like to add something to that. There are those people who believe that the people who go to the rallies are, in fact, deserve what they get. And I don't. I mean, you know, if they're stupid, if they are making a huge mistake that could cost them and their families their lives, that's awful. But the fact is, they don't deserve it. That's what I'm thinking.
That's very magnanimous.
You think that's magnanimous?
Yeah.
So
you think? So wait. So are you telling us that you think they do deserve it?
Well, I'm going to get into trouble if I say what I really think about this, but there is a certain smacking of the lips when you hear about a young woman who holds a big party and brings a bunch of friends, and they don't wear masks, and they don't social distance, and then they all end up with the virus. And you've all read those stories.
Okay.
I'm somewhat sympathetic to her. I mean, the fact of the matter is she admitted she was wrong. She said she was stupid, and she was, and she doesn't deserve the disease.
Unlike our president, yes, who has not admitted to anything. But it's so easy to have what you want, but to be safe. You know, I have not cut myself off completely from friends, but we're very careful to sit apart. We check. We don't come if we're ill. We wear masks. It's not such a big sacrifice when you look at other things that Americans in previous generations sacrificed for the sake of the public good. We have lost the concept of public good, and Trump definitely is to blame, but he is not the only person to blame. People who think only of themselves are a big part of the problem.
So here's
yet,
the back.
Sorry, one last thing. And yet you and I, Rosemary, are in contact with our grandchildren. We see them and we know there's a risk when we do that because kids play with other kids and all the rest of it. But we do it anyway. Everybody, to some degree, has some vulnerability. No? or NISPA?
Well, so do all those protesters who very bravely said, we're not stupid, we know the risk, we'll wear masks and we'll try to social distance, but you can't in a protest, especially when you're running from police. But this is so important that protesting police brutality and systematic racism is so important. To me, seeing my granddaughter is so important. Yes, I will take a risk. But not just, I'm not going to sign away my rights. And as that letter writer pointed out, yeah, it's to go and create a spectacle for Donald Trump. It's not to stand up for him. It's not to help him win. It's simply to be part of a spectacle.
We got two letters.
And Joe, can I jump in on that, though,
sure.
Real quickly? Sorry, Joe. You know, and I think one of the big difference, though, is that at the Trump rally, if you do wear a mask, you know that you're going to get a certain degree of backlash from the people there because of the position that the president has taken. And I think that's what's one of the most disturbing things about it. If they said, hey, listen, we're going to do this because it's part of the democratic process, but we're asking people to be safe and to follow some really basic safety procedures, like they did with the protests, I would feel a little bit differently than this idea of not only am I going to do it because of my ego, but if you are going to show up, you're going to have to not do something that's safe. So, I mean, there's a lot going on there.
Here's an example of the division on this. We got a letter from Renee who says, Rosemary is correct. People have their own agency, informed or not. They have responsibility for their actions and decisions. Otherwise, we are contemptuous of others who behave in ways troubling to us. They deserve the respect of their choices and consequences as well. Aren't they responsible for support of Trump? Then the other side of this is Neville, who says, seems like Rosemary is the latest victim of Trump's new world chaos. Please give her an opportunity to retract her statement if you're stupid enough to go to Trump's rally, despite the obvious risks and flashing warning sign of the RNC's written disclaimer. People in power, public officials, professionals, and others have unique responsibilities that go along with their positions of granted power and authority. It is not a crime to be, quote unquote, stupid, and people should be protected, and our laws do protect those that would exploit for their ignorance. Rosemary.
Well, I think I'll decline that opportunity to retract. And I did not say it was against the law. I said it was stupid. You're taking a personal risk. And it is for what, to go to a rally that will make no ultimate difference. So, the government is giving, the government in the form of Donald Trump is giving bad advice. His supporters will mock you if you do take measures, which apparently will be available at the insistence of Tulsa officials at that rally, including masks and hand sanitizers. I think Bob is right that if you scored some hand sanitizer, you're going to be mocked as a coward. But you know that going in. You really have to be completely unaware if you don't know that going in. So you're part of it. You're part of the group at Columbus, Ohio, who yelled at reporters, masked reporters. You're just doing this on purpose. You're trying to scare people. It's all your fault. Well, no, actually not. And I think that's a choice that you make. I don't think that's chaos. That's individualism.
The problem with the argument, and yes, we all do have agency, and we all make our individual decisions. The problem is that if you go contract the, if you're young and strong, and you think that you'll be okay if you get the virus, that's fine and good. But then if you get it and then spread it around to a bunch of people who are vulnerable, that's not fine and good, you know. So And that's true of the protests, too. I mean, I think there are probably a lot of listeners who are kind of shaking their heads at the idea that it's okay to go to a protest. And I support the protest, but then the people are going to condemn people who go to a Trump rally. You kind of can't play it both ways. I mean, if it's okay to gather, it's okay to gather. If it's not okay to gather, it's not okay to gather. And the thought has always been that we have to think about the most vulnerable. You know, the people who go to the protests have been, by and large, pretty young. And I think that is because older people are avoiding crowds. But then you wonder what those younger people do when they...
The older people in the crowds have been pushed by cops and end up with fractured skulls, which is also a dangerous situation. But part of the precaution...
Yeah, that's true.
You do go to a protest, when you do go visit your granddaughter, you self-isolate later. That's one of the steps which can be taken.
Right.
So I don't think you need a blanket. blanket rule. Either you can collect or you cannot. And if we did have that, Chris, it would be that we are collecting, that they're pushing the economy to open. So if it's worthwhile to open the economy and risk the disease, you know, why not go to a rally, I guess. That's why I think individuals have to make a decision about the risk that they're taking and if it's worth it.
I want to, if I may, Joe, just for a second, step in here, because I always like to try to figure out what the hell people who are endangering themselves and their families and their kids could do. Now, if you assume that they're just troublemakers and whatever, you know, that's one thing. But I don't think that that's what's at stake here. Look, we know what's going on. We know Donald Trump is a racist. We know that the crowd behind him are racists. And they believe, really believe, that they're right on this, that, you know, that America's being taken over by bad people, and blacks and browns and others will take over our white privilege. And they believe that. That's the important thing to remember. It's disgusting. It's deplorable. It's awful. But they believe it, and they're willing to risk their health and the health of their families as a result of that.
But another point to this, absolutely, Alan. The other point to this, though, we can avoid this, right? It could be easily avoided if the president said, as Bob indicated earlier, there are other ways of having a rally, and this isn't the way to do it.
Well, he can't do that. I mean, his early political success was those rallies. He was popular during that time. And he's saying, if I can't go back to those rallies, I'm going to lose this election, and I don't give a damn about anybody else. I don't care about them. The only thing that matters to me is that I win this election.
Norm is doing some math. Well, go ahead, Chris.
I was going to say, I mean, the reason he's having this rally is because it's pretty obvious that the support in his base is starting to sag. And he feels like these rallies are one of the ways that he rallies, so to speak, his base. And he's probably right about that. I mean, it doesn't justify having the rally, but that is why he's having it.
As long as you know, all of a sudden you don't get thousands of your supporters sick because it undermines sort of your key policy position. One other thought that I'll toss out for one of my concerns that I've seen about the protests is at the same time we're asking for some basic protective measures, you know, wear a face mask. We're seeing, I think, an overusage of things like tear gas, which both harms the nasal passages, the airways, the lungs, forces people to actually take the protective gear off. And you know, that's something that we're not spending a lot of time talking about, that the less than lethal, I'm saying that in air quotes for everybody at home, police practices right now are actually even more dangerous given the fact that the virus is in the communities. Sorry to make a jump all the way, but it's I think it's an interesting connection.
Absolutely.
Go ahead. And I also thought it was really funny that the cuckoo clock was going off behind
Rosemary.
So did Rosemary.
I. Were we hacked?
No.
I thought we might be hacked when that happened. Rosemary was talking and the cuckoo clock was going off. And that's exactly the kind of thing a hacker would do.
Okay, I'm guilty about that. That is a souvenir from the Black Forest in Germany. I don't even hear it anymore.
So we have two letters on the cuckoo clock. Eric said, just a heads up, Rosemary, your cuckoo clock seems to be running 7 minutes fast.
No, it's a work of art. It's not a timepiece. it's hours off. I just like the sound and the look of it, but I'm going to have to not wind it up before the radio program from now on.
No one's complaining. Jules writes and says, the clock going off in the background when Rosemary was speaking seems like a perfect characterization of the rally, as it says cuckoo, cuckoo. So, you know, this is, by the way, this is what we'll get the most letters about, the cuckoo clock. Let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, Rosemary Armeo, and her cuckoo clock. We will continue after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We do love your letters, panel@wamc.org, and welcome back. Let's go to another story making the news this morning, and I want to talk about this. We can do it briefly, but I am interested in the panel's thoughts on the fight over the Bolton book. It continues. Justice Department asks court to order Bolton to stop the release of his book. They filed a lawsuit Tuesday asking a federal judge to order former White House National Security Advisor John Bolton to stop the release of his book, asserting that his much-anticipated memoir contains classified material. The move sets up a legal showdown between President Trump and the longtime conservative foreign policy hand, who alleges in his book that the president committed Ukraine-like transgressions in a number of foreign policy decisions, according to the publisher of the book. But the Trump administration stopped short of seeking a court order against Bolton's publisher to stop the distribution of the book, The Room Where It Happened, a White House memoir, which is due to go on sale June 23rd, which I believe is next Tuesday, and has already shipped across the country, which means that bookstores have it in their back rooms, it's been embargoed, and they're not allowed to put it out onto the shelves until Tuesday. Instead, the civil suit filed in U.S. District Court in Washington accuses Bolton of breach of contract by violating his non-disclosure agreement and asks the court to order him, quote, to instruct or request his publisher, insofar as he has the authority to do so, to further delay the release. Rosemary.
Well, it's interesting. I don't like any of the players in this. You know, I think that Bolton needed to speak out about these issues when it mattered, which was during the impeachment or even before, and he decided to put it all into his book so that we would buy it. And now Trump plainly is just delaying publication. He's just messing with them. And that would all be just fine if there weren't a First Amendment issue involved here. It appears that Bolton did everything he was supposed to clear that material and be allowed to publish. And at the last minute, Trump pulled this, the White House pulled this. So that is worrisome. And it's also worrisome that what really is happening in that White House, we still don't know about it. All the voices of people who could tell us, except for the leakers, have been silenced or have been co-opted. So that's it.
Alan?
Well, it seems to me it might well be a shiny, bright object again. Look, this book is all over the place. Every bookstore has it. I mean, what kind of nonsense is it to expect that somebody isn't going to let everybody know what's in the book? And how much could there be in the book? But, you know, Trump is a master at creating this sort of diffusion of information. People, you know, he's a magician. You look at this hand, but what's going on is in the other hand. You know, I don't know what to make of it, really.
Chris Churchill. Not hearing Chris Churchill, I will go to Bob Griffin. Bob.
Thanks, Joe. You know, it's also, I think, a sign of the continuing decline of Department of Justice as a fair arbiter of justice rather than a club for the president. I agree with Rosemary that this is incredibly personal. It's very vindictive, which is in keeping with the Trump's history. And it's also intended to send a very chilling message to other folks that may be thinking about coming forward or stepping forward with their own publications or to tell their own story, with the fact that they're going to try to go after your potential revenue stream. I also think that the book does have the potential, though, to reignite some of the concerns that were raised, and I thought validated in the impeachment process, which is going to be very, very interesting to watch.
If you were Bolton, what would you do?
If I were Bolton, I would go on a book tour, and I would make as much money as I could. And if they continue to block, I'd get my publisher's attorneys to go to court and sue the federal government, and then sue Barr and Trump personally.
Yeah, me too. I think that's exactly what he should do.
Chris Churchill.
So I missed some of this conversation, but we're sympathetic to Bolton now. Is that the drift I'm getting?
Because no.
No, Rosemary started off by saying she doesn't like any of the players involved in this.
Okay. Yeah, because, I mean, there's plenty to fault here with him. I mean, he kept apparently a lot of juicy details in this book that maybe he should have come forward about a lot earlier than he did.
but wanted to save them so he could make a little money on the book. I kind of find that a little bit sleazy.
No, I think that's just that's just sleazy, I think.
Yeah, what did I say? A little bit sleazy?
A little bit sleazy. I think it's just sleazy, but yeah.
Yeah, it's sleazy. And, there were times when he could have given an interview. He didn't have to. He sometimes acted as if he wasn't called to testify, then he had no voice whatsoever, and he had to save it all for the book. But he could have given interviews. He could have done a lot of things that would have gotten some of the details that are apparently in this book out a lot earlier.
Rosemary, were you going to say something? I'm sorry.
No, I don't think so. I do agree that he has to fight this in the courts and in public opinion. I'd leak a copy to a national security reporter for the New York Times or the Washington Post.
I guarantee you by the end of... As the book hits bookstores, Alan's absolutely right. By the time, this goes on all the time. One of those copies.
It's in the bookstores.
Yeah, I mean, it's sitting in the back rooms of a lot of these places. It's going to get out.
Yeah, there's no stopping it now. I mean, it has already been sent to newspapers. I mean, they're all, presumably have reviewers reading the book right this second. This cat's out of the bag.
Are you going to interview him, Joe, when his book does come out?
I have put in a request. I would love to interview him, but cool. I doubt it'll happen. But that's fine.
Well, no, I don't know. You're at the top of their list. It's amazing the gets that Joe gets. because they watch the meter as people get interviewed on Joe's show, and we know because we talk to people. That's the reason they're there, in addition to his being a great interviewer, of course.
I'm just guessing that that maybe they think that people who buy John Bolton books would not necessarily be listeners to this radio station, but I don't know that for a fact. But we'll see what happens. We have a lot of letters I want to get to. We're still on the protests. Bob says Trump's rally goers see themselves as soldiers in his army. His rallies just give them a chance to die for their leader. Works for me, says Bob. That is a quote from him. Also,
it's a different Bob than me, though.
Yes, very, very much so. Let's see. Anne says the difference between a rally and a protest is a protest is outdoors with masks. The rally is indoors without masks. Where do you think the virus will spread? Then we got this from Doug, who says, I really could care less if stupid people want to can't do cannonballs into the Darwin pool, except that the splash can hit the rest of us. Thank you, Doug, for a very fun letter. Lynn says, I wish I could say that the mask, no mask issue was a red or blue state issue. Unfortunately, I see just as many folks in my neighborhood who are known progressives, some of them elected officials, wandering around maskless and not social distancing. Some of them are friends, and it becomes awkward, even dangerous, when they approach us as we retreat backwards. I find myself backing into trees, falling off curbs, tripping over shrubs. We tactfully remind them of the benefits of the mask. Sadly, we are ignored. Good point.
You know, I have a friend who is she's just wonderful at this. She never is, like, blunt and mean like I am, but she just politely says, I'm an old bird. Could you please put on the mask? And people do. Again, we have agency. You don't have to back into a bush. You just say, that makes me nervous. Would you mind? And people do comply. Some of it is just, it's hard to get used to the idea that you have to walk around with a mask on.
Yeah, and Joe, maybe that's the answer I've been looking for, that Trump was actually trying to get away from the general going down the ramp that way rather than what he said he was doing. Something to think about.
Yeah, that's a good point. While I believe it is ill-advised to attend a rally, wishing attendees ill will is not good for anyone. If supporters travel to his rallies like groupies, they will travel from other states to Oklahoma. And if they get sick, they will travel home and spread to others when they go to the grocery store, work, for a walk, etc. There should be an active effort to stop indoor rallies from happening. This is a public health issue.
Clear. I'm not wishing them ill will. What I'm wishing is that they don't go, that they save themselves and embarrass the president. That's my real wish. If they do go and they become ill, I'm not to blame. That's
Chris?
It.
You know, it is, when you take a step back, it is pretty remarkable that we don't have any concerts, we don't have any professional sports, we have really canceled all gatherings everywhere in the country, and yet the very first big indoor rally that's going to happen is being thrown by the President of the United States. I mean, sometimes it is just shocking. You know, but the one thing I will say, though, is we keep acting as though this rally is going to be packed and it's going to be full of people who aren't wearing masks. I mean, we still have to see if that's the case. It's possible that the place is, you know, half empty and that a large part of the crowd is wearing masks. I mean, we just don't know yet. You know, maybe we're not giving people enough credit.
Interestingly, the president, in his usual accurate manner, is saying that a million people have asked for tickets, and this is for a venue that holds something less than 20,000 people.
And there was even some talk of adding another venue, right? Yeah. So.
Yeah. There's also some talk of sabotage going on where people are requesting tickets who have no intention of going. So who knows? Who really knows what the truth is?
Good point. Caroline says the difference I see between the protests I've attended and rallies is that at the protests, almost everyone I saw wearing a mask and was attempting to social distance to the greatest extent possible. I don't see the majority of Trump supporters wearing masks when Trump himself has set the example that masks are not important. Also, having gone to protests, protesters are encouraged to get tested regardless of symptoms. Will the rally attendees do the same?
I just have to say I don't think that's true. I have nothing but respect for the writer, but when you look at the TV and you see those people standing next to each other and a lot of them without masks on, you know, you can't just make it up and say, well, those are the good people and the bad people are not doing that. You know, look, you know, there are foolish people everywhere, including at these rallies.
We get a couple of letters. Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah. Well, my personal experience, I mean, I haven't gone to all the rallies around here, but I've observed a few, and there are people wearing masks, but there are a lot of people who aren't, and there is very little social distancing going on, at least of the couple that I've seen.
Got a couple letters on the Bolton book. Jeremy says if Bolton's book were released during the impeachment, it would not have produced a guilty vote by the Senate. It's probably going to have more impact now. Michael says...
I want to step in on that.
Yep.
You know, to me, that's not right. You know, it won't have a lot of impact now. It wouldn't have had a lot of impact before, because the people who are behind Trump are behind Trump, period, end of discussion.
Mike corrects us and says John Bolton's decision to tell the truth for profit after the fact, but not while it was his constitutional duty, is not just sleazy, it is criminal. Linda says the courts can let Trump win this against Bolton's book. Trump is trying to set precedent that no one can report on any words Trump says, because Trump is saying anything he says is confidential. Bolton needs to just publish.
We need to go to Rosemary on this one, because Rosemary's been profound in the last couple of days in mentioning Supreme Court history. I read, for whatever it's worth, that the Supreme Court does not like this kind of stuff and has ruled against, you know, no information getting out. Rosemary, can you help me with that?
Well, yeah, prior restraint is one of the oldest ideas that the court has trumped down. And so newspapers and media outlets have taken the view that we put it out and then take a punishment. And that's what Bolton is, that's what his publishers are doing. The difficulty here, though, is that it's national security. Trump is saying everything I say is confidential and it impacts on national security. He was the national security advisor, and that makes the court more conservative, and it makes people kind of crazy. The difficulty, though, is that in this case, Bolton did everything he should have to clear the information he used in the book. Simon & Schuster, his publisher, they've done these kind of books before, and so you probably have to think that it's done right, and it really is completely Trump going after him for personal reasons.
Yeah. Chris, you were going to say?
Well, I was just going to say that, I mean, he did sign a pre-publication agreement. I don't know if you guys talked about that when I was gone, but, I mean, I don't know how that factors into the legal ramifications, you know. he signed an agreement that gives the White House the kind of a little bit of veto power. And, you know, this isn't unique to the Trump White House. There have been authors before who've been really frustrated by this process.
That's true, but he went through it. He complied with the terms of that agreement, and it was reviewed, and it was fine up until...
Aren't they arguing that the process wasn't complete yet, though, that he went ahead with publication before that process was complete? I mean, I agree with you that what Trump is doing is mostly about just trying to stamp out negative press. Of course, in usual Trump fashion, he's magnifying everything that Bolton's saying by going after him instead of just ignoring it, you know, which is what most PR experts, I think, would tell him to do.
Now, into all of this comes John Roberts, right? The new hero of the liberal to the slightly left community who have been saying for days now, you see, Roberts is really a good guy. He's going to make sure that there's balance here. Oh, yeah, well, Roberts is well known for presidential power and for subscribing to presidential power. And my bet is when this one, if it reaches the Supreme Court, there's no predictable outcome.
Well, I think some of it will hinge on what that publication agreement actually says.
Hold on.
It's already out, and so the court takes that into consideration. They're not going to say burn all the copies of the books that are out.
So Lee writes and says, ha, I already have a copy of the book. Clearly, Mr. Bolton took extensive notes. The book is full of day-to-day details about the chaos and insanity of the Trump White House. I'm enjoying a behind-the-scenes peek, but not shocked so far. We knew most of this. The book simply confirms what we already surmised. I haven't yet gotten to the part about the Ukraine hijinks. Something to look forward to.
Yeah, just make sure you wash your hands after reading that book. That's my only recommendation.
And
maybe the rest of the show should just be her reading the book, and we can all just sit back and listen.
I know. Just tell her to go to the good parts.
With the cuckoo in the background.
Trump says every conversation he has is confidential. Then technically he is breaking the law with every tweet he makes. That is Terry's take on the Bolton book. Chris says, we've had 4 years of Trump. This is for you, Rosemary. This is from Chris, who says, we've had 4 years of Trump in the national spotlight, and the media still cannot effectively counter his dishonesty. It's not like he's changed tactics in that time. It seems more like a failure on the media's part.
I can't disagree. I think the media is struggling to figure out how to cover this presidency with the respect and attention that we have traditionally given to presidents. Yes, that's true. You're seeing it in all the disputes that we have talked about here, like the New York Times editorial shakeup, when they ran Tom Cotton, a Trump supporter, when they ran his views on sending in the troops against the protest, which is pretty standard procedure, and there was a furor about it, and we ended up shaking up the whole editorial page. Now, wherever you stand on that, it certainly is a sign that the media is trying to figure out the best way to cover this administration.
No matter how good they cover, I mean, they're putting the truth as they understand it out, and if the people aren't going to listen, I don't know where the line is between the media or the news not doing their job versus the people not doing their job. I actually have more credit to the news agencies. I almost feel like they're Cassandra from, you know, if you think about your Trojan mythology, you know, she was cursed with the gift of prophecy, but nobody would believe her. And it's the same thing. I think the Times has been trying to wave, you know, to show this big bright light on this problem, and people are just ignoring it.
Yeah, well, that's certainly part of the issue, but also you write a headline that's accurate in that it quotes the president, and people explode because you're accepting his nuanced view of things, less than nuanced view of things, so you're biased. It doesn't seem, if you cover his rallies gavel to gavel, are you showing how ridiculous and crazy he is, or are you giving him free publicity? It's everything in this presidency seems to be a double-edged sword. We have not hit on the way to accurately portray Pinocchio's, which, you know, we're counting the number of lies he has. Very interesting innovation, never done before for a president, but it's now seen by conservatives as proof that the media is out to get him. Your own paper today has a story about how it's ridiculous that we're looking at his health after his stumbling walk and his inability to lift a glass. That was just prejudice against the president. It's people are reading this. They just think it's the media has some sort of bias, and it's hard to argue against that.
We have this from Joe, who writes, "You all are again underestimating the voodoo of Trump. You're assuming that the Tulsa rally will be a carbon copy of his 2015 rallies. Wrongo. Trump is faking everyone out right now. I predict he will land on his feet by unexpectedly handing out Trump masks and mini bottles of sanitizer to all attendees." I don't see that happening, but all right. "That will make it right for him, his adoring disciples, Dr. Fauci, his blood-sucking lawyers, and all fake news media." That from Joe. We talked on Monday about this, though, that... I just lost my train of thought completely, so I'll stop.
Hey Joe, can I jump in?
Yes. I think I'll think of what I was going to say. Go ahead.
I think it's funny that we could have a Trump brand PPE. I mean, it's just another corporation that he can drive into bankruptcy.
Yeah. So what I was thinking of, Rosemary, I believe it was you who earlier this week, it may not have been, but I think it was you that said, you know, the big concern here is that because of all of the hullabaloo over this rally and in Tulsa and the date and the move and the change, is that the one thing that will be reminiscent of 2015 is, will all the cable networks carry it live? And I don't know, but why wouldn't they? Right, Alan? I mean, that's what they do. It is news.
I don't see how they could not, to be honest with you, because if MSNBC carries it, CNN doesn't carry it, and he makes news, that's the name of the game.
Bob, any thoughts on that?
I agree. I think particularly with having so many people at home right now, sort of being fixated on TV, that it's, you're going to see actually an increase in viewership because of it.
I mean, I was just sitting here trying to imagine what I would do if I were a cable news executive, whether I would carry it or not. And I think I probably would.
Okay. So
with reservations, but you know, but I, it is clearly newsworthy, you know. I mean, just like we were saying earlier, there are no gatherings going on anywhere in the country, and here's a president throwing a mass gathering. It's indoor rallies going on anywhere in the country. We never know what he's going to say. Things that are both inflammatory and newsworthy. It'd be hard not to show it.
Rosemary, you going to watch it?
I would watch every minute of it. I would put it on with commentary. The problem in 2015 is that they just ran it without anybody saying, no, that's not true, that's not true, that's not true. Oh, my gosh, look what he did here. That's what I want to hear.
Well, also in 2015 and 16, I mean, they ran every single rally. It wasn't fair, especially during the Republican primary, it wasn't fair to the other candidates. He was sucking up all the oxygen. And CNN was just letting him, you know, it was almost nightly, you know. I mean,
right.
This is a little bit different in that this is the first one after kind of a long break. It comes at a very difficult time for the country. I agree,
think we came to the same conclusion, but the point still remains. When you see an entire rally, a Trump rally, are you horrified? Like, oh, my God, he's crazy. Don't vote for him. Or do you come away thinking, oh, he's different. Wow, he says what he really thinks. I'm going to vote for him.
I think it's baked in. I think it's already baked into the cake, but a lot of people will hate watch. It will rally his base, so it will kind of excite his base a little bit, I'm sure. You know, like I said earlier, the poll numbers suggest that base is sagging, and that independents, who might have been sympathetic to Trump, have really turned away. And it might help him get some of those people
back. I have to take a quick...
But it's also popular that it could backfire. Go ahead.
I got to take a break. We'll be right back. I have no idea what's happening in that music, but I'm transfixed by it. Welcome back to the program. Rosemary Armeo, Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, and Alan Shartok, and we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. We would love to hear from you. Let's talk about baseball for a moment. We've been talking about mass gatherings, but what if you don't have any fans at all? So... this is a big deal that we're hearing about when the Major League Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred made his comments to ESPN on Monday. The big, bold statement jumped out. He was not confident there would be a 2020 season. He accused the baseball, the players' union, of bad faith tactics and the part with which everyone associated with the sport could agree. The stalemate with the union over money, he said, is a disaster for the game. But the more important phrase is, at least in regards to where the sport goes from here, with nearly 3 months of its season already lost to the coronavirus pandemic and a dwindling calendar in which to squeeze one in, were subtle and conciliatory. He said, as long as there's no dialogue, important that we find a way to get past it, get the game back on the field. The upshot following several ugly days of absolutes and lines drawn in the sand, the union declaring the negotiation was effectively over, Major League Baseball signaling its intention to impose a season of its choosing in the absence of a deal. It now appears Manfred and his lieutenants are hoping to restart negotiations over a deal for the 2020 season. Who is interested in this particular subject amongst the panelists?
Well, I am.
I'll jump.
Please, go ahead.
Yeah. Go ahead, Bob.
I mean,
Chris. Go ahead, Chris.
I mean, it's distressing. This is a moment where baseball could kind of provide a national uplift in ways it has during crises before. And, you know, it's a dispute over money. It's going to prevent that from happening. I mean, part of me thinks it's going to be a little weird to watch baseball without any fans in the stands anyways. And is it really baseball if there's nobody sitting there watching? But, you know, what's really going to get embarrassing for baseball is that the other sports are ready to come back, and they are going to come back. They've been able to work this out, and yet somehow baseball hasn't. And by the way, it's the owners who are the greedy ones in this fight. Nobody should blame the players. This is all on the owners, who have seen the values of their teams go up 5-6 times in the last, 10 years, and they're unwilling to share any of that with the players. So
a union issue, because the players' union is holding a lot of cards right now. If the owners impose a season, as I understand it, the players will grieve their really cut-rate pay that the owners plan to give them. And they might win. They win so much that's why you're seeing backtracking among the owners. And that's a lesson, that collective action is still the best way to get good workplace conditions.
Well, I mean, all the players want is a prorated salary. If they play 40 games, they want to be paid, a percentage that they would have got, the percentage that they per game that they would have gotten if it had been a full season. And I think since they're the ones who are putting themselves on the line, they're the ones who have to be separated from their families potentially for months while the season plays out. They're the ones who are going to, risk contracting the virus. That doesn't seem unreasonable.
Or risk getting an injury in a little short season that's not going to have a big effect on anything other than their health. So that's why I'm saying that if they bring a grievance, they have a really great chance of winning it. And the owners have to know that. It's quite an interesting little showdown, even if you don't like the sport.
It is an interesting showdown. Yeah. Bob, what were you thinking?
I have a couple observations. When someone made the comment about baseball with no fans, but then again, most people are asleep in the stands anyway, because baseball's got to be one of the more boring sports around.
Oh, you're going to get letters.
That's okay. Yeah. There is a big part of me that actually says I'm fine with the baseball season being canceled and the NFL season being canceled, because that means that Tom Brady would never play for anybody but the Patriots.
I agree with you so much, Bob, on that.
That would be fine with me.
I agree with you. But, it looks, I don't know, even without fans, I don't know how you send players around the country into all of these different markets and all of these different situations. Just looking right now at, Texas, Florida, and Arizona, these are big baseball markets. And I don't know how you do that and keep everybody safe on top of what else they're dealing with here.
Yeah, and you're going to run into issues.
I'm sorry, Bob.
If I could jump with two serious notes, one is going to be very interesting. The English Premier League kicks back off today, and that's actually a global league if you really think about the popularity.
It's just on the BBC. This is soccer, right?
Yeah, and they're not going to have fans, so it's going to be really interesting to watch that. But where I'm very sympathetic to both this, to a professional athlete is, if you think about what happens if they get COVID, I mean, they're such finely tuned athletes. Their body is so important, that COVID could be the career ending disease for them, even if it's not fatal. So, I mean, there's an awful lot at stake to be bringing these top athletes back this way.
It gets tricky, too, because if one player tests positive, basically the whole team has to be quarantined. I mean, these guys share locker rooms. They're sharing a lot of close space.
Right.
So then how do you play out the schedule at that point if one team can't play? Right? I mean, it's there are a lot of potential complications, and it'll be interesting to see. You know, in a way, it's a little bit easier for the Premier League because they play once a week. But baseball's a daily sport. If a team is quarantined for 2 weeks, I mean, their whole season, especially in the shortened season, is gone, you know. It'll be interesting, I mean, if it ever happens.
Right, and that's the big question. We have a few minutes. Breaking news here that I just got in, and it's not a big story at all, but I was interested in it. The Aunt Jemima brand of syrup and pancake mix will get a new name and image, according to Quaker Oats, the company. Said that they recognize that Aunt Jemima's origins are based on a racial stereotype. The 130-year-old brand features a black woman named Aunt Jemima, who was originally dressed as a minstrel character. The picture has changed over time, and in recent years, Quaker removed the mammy kerchief from the character to blunt growing criticism that the brand perpetuated a racist stereotype that dated to the days of slavery. But Quaker, which is a subsidiary of who? Anybody? Pepsi Cola, said removing the image and name as part of an effort by the company to, quote, make progress towards racial equality.
You know, I've always worried about this one.
130 years it took them to figure out it was racist?
Yeah, I've always seen it that way. And it's extraordinary that it took this long, but now it's done.
Anybody else?
Well, since we're talking about sports, when is the name Washington Redskins?
The Land O'Lakes Butter Girl. It's God, we're becoming almost a diverse culture. Finally,
what's the Land O'Lakes Butter Girl?
She was removed from the packaging on Land O'Lakes Butter. You know,
oh, because of the Native American. Okay, right, got it. Chris, you were saying? I'm sorry.
No, it was designed by a Native American.
I was saying, since we were talking about sports, how much longer does the Washington Redskins name have? I mean, that's one of the worst things going.
Horrible. And you know, we keep on going through these spits and spurts where they are this comes up and the team just says, no, we're not going to do it, and seems to get away with it. And I don't know how they continually get away with it.
No, I think Chris is right.
Yeah,
this is the moment.
Much longer.
Yeah, I agree with you.
I think it's kind of worse. Washington, D.C. is not a state or has state status.
Yeah, but it's still in a sports league, and that team is making a lot of money. I don't know. It's just concerning.
Well, it's coming to a head because the Redskins want a new stadium, and the officials in D.C. saying they're not going to give them any public support unless the name is changed. So, dollars may finally.
The Redskins.
I'm sorry, Rosemary.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to interrupt. I can't tell when I'm here, but I do love how the Washington Post refused to refer to the Redskins. They
yeah,
call it the Washington.
You know, I was listening to NPR on my walk this morning. Pardon me. And there was a guy on who had just written a book about why we need to do reparations for people of color, and I'm thinking about that very issue, the Native Americans in this country. If you're going to give out reparations, and I think you should, then what about reparations for the people we really harmed from the moment we got here?
And
we really harmed blacks, too.
Yeah, no, I'm not suggesting for a second we didn't. We did.
There is a good piece in the Washington Post today of calling for it, saying now is the time. Sorry, long past due. Look around this country. The best we can hope is that the death of George Floyd while in police custody leads us to someplace better that we're more able to understand the perspective of others, or at least listen to them, think about them, embrace them. If the NFL season opens as planned with training camps this summer, Washington's team should do so under another name, under its new name, whatever that might be, put it on the ballot, and then mail it in. So, interesting to see if that that changes. But again, I mean, same thing about the Anchorage. You wonder of how it has gotten through so many. We've had these conversations a lot over the years, and a great scrutiny over the name of the Redskins, and yet they have not given in.
Yeah, but Joe, something made them do it now. In other words, well, they're not reached the Rubicon.
I mean, I hope so. I mean, I hope you're right. I just mean that there's so many other times that it seems the moment where other teams have changed their names, and other teams have been certainly more apologetic for what they have done. The Redskins have not done that, and I wonder. You know, I hope now is the time. I don't know.
Well, it was for Aunt Jemima, that's for sure. Something made it happen.
I got a letter from. Go ahead.
Just real quickly on the Redskins name, you know, if the NFL would take it seriously and apply some pressure, and frankly, if the season ticket holders in D.C. Would start voting with their feet, they'd change the name really quickly.
People didn't buy the merchandise.
Right.
Absolutely. It all comes back to dollars, particularly with the owner Schneider down there. So this idea of just throwing up your hands, I think there are things they could do. What I'm hoping though is that we are actually in the first steps of making substantive change rather than sort of the typical hand wringing that we've seen for so many decades.
I noticed, Bob, that you're talking about personal agency again. We don't have to accept the name that the owners give it. We just don't go to the game and you force action. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, and I mean, to me, there's a lot of players in this. It seems like the TV networks could have. You mentioned the Washington Post not using the name. I mean, the TV networks don't have to run the games. I mean, a lot could be done to force a change.
What about the players? What about the players who play for the team? I mean, if they all said one day, we're not playing until the name is changed, I think the name would change pretty quickly.
Yeah, I agree. We'll see if that happens. We are out of time. I want to thank everybody for being with us. Alan, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Chris, Rosemary, and Bob, I appreciate you being with us. Very nice to have you, and we will be back with the Congressional Corner right after this.